I wanted to take our Sunday evenings this month and go back to the Old Testament. Now, there's, frankly, for me, there's a difficulty in this. The difficulty is that we kind of grow up learning the Bible stories. David and Goliath, Samson and Delilah, Samson pushing down the pillars of the temple, all these different things. Those are stories. That's interesting. But what is the biblical truth for us today? Now, if we were Reformed, no problem, because Israel is the church, and the church is Israel. So it's all the same thing, you know. This is why you find the old Presbyterian, so on, still talking about a parish as though there's a certain plot of land that belongs to them, because Israel received the promise of land, you see. It's the Reformed people that are talking about win back America, as though America really had ever been Christian. You see, Israel was God's country because God said so. What we had here was a grand experiment of many Christian people coming and making a dominant focus of Christian belief and so on right here in America. So we had a good Christian heritage, no question. But this is not God's land. It never was. How quickly, if you read American literature, how quickly the idea turned away from exalting Christ, exalting the Bible, and went to the exalting the ideas of man. No, we can't go there. That's not our way. So what we need to do is to say, in that situation, this was going on. How does that compare to our situation? So we want to look tonight at Elijah and Ahab, and that's Elijah on the right there in the hairy man wearing the leather and so on, and the silken robes, Ahab and his wife Jezebel. My subtitle is Confronting a Rebellious Culture. I think it is here that we will find, in fact, we've got somebody coming forward already. Conviction of sin. There we go. Okay, great. Backed up for you. You and I live in a rebellious culture. Here's the thing about America. We had a Christian emphasis in our culture. Unmistakable. The unbelievers hated it. And now they have the upper hand. And we are seeing what they were kept crying for. Please be tolerant of us. Please be tolerant. Now they have the upper hand. They're not tolerant of us at all. So, you and I are living in a rebellious culture, not just a sinful culture, but one that is actively rebelling against the Christian background that they had. They would consider it a Christian culture, therefore they would have an excuse not to have to, you know, it's not a command of God, just a cultural thing. So if we understand that's a commonality here, now we can approach this with an understanding of what's going on. So let me begin with the background that King Ahab did evil. Here, think of him as the leader of the people. In our culture, the leader of the people are the media people, actors and actresses, the politicians, the shakers and the movers, you know. 1 Kings, we're going to be reading most of 1 Kings 16, 17, 18, 19, 11. But this is to move the story along. 1 Kings 16, Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him. And that's saying a lot. This was the worst guy yet. And it came to pass, as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, went and served Baal and worshipped him. Jezebel's father was called Ethbaal. You get an idea who he was honoring? His family, he honored Baal and worshipped him. And he, that is Ahab, in Israel, reared up an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. And Ahab made, this is the word meaning produced, a grove. I wanted to show you that the Hebrew word here is Asherah. That is not, he planted a grove like, oh, what an evil man, you know. This is, he produced a place of worship called the Asherah. And the Asherah were like trees, but they were shafts. And it's an ugly thing, but think of what straight shafts might represent in a pagan land. And that's what all this was about. And Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. Now, it's one thing to have the main guy doing this, saying, I will not be held by the standards of the people before me. I'm a free thinker. God may have been worshipped before, but there are other gods. And so, I'm just going to go my own way. But this led the people to do evil. And this is what we see today, that it just spreads out, keeps spreading out. And here's a great example. Long ago, Joshua, when they'd first come into the land, and they had Jericho had been defeated, the city of Jericho, Joshua gave a warning prophecy, Joshua 6:26. And Joshua adjured them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before the Lord that riseth up and buildeth this city Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and his youngest son shall, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it. So you set up the foundation, and the last thing you do is put the gates on the wall. So he says his eldest will die at the beginning, and his youngest will die at the ending. That was the curse, that was a prophecy. Never happened until Ahab became king. We stopped at verse 33. Verse 34 says, in his days, in Ahab's days, did Hiel the Bethelite build Jericho. And guess what happened? He laid the foundation thereof in Abiram, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof in his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by Joshua, son of Nun. So God had not changed, had he? They said, we can do anything we want. We're not going to be bound by your superstition. But they were fighting against the fact of reality. What's going on around us today is they say, your religion's past tense, old-fashioned. We don't have to pay attention to that. And now, child abuse, venereal disease, all kinds of sexual problems are rampant, pandemic. To date now means to get together and have sex. This is just the way of things. And they can't understand why things are going so bad in the culture. Weeping over the mistreated children. This is the way of things. God hasn't changed. So we see the background. Secondly, I want you to notice that God's man rebuked the prevailing culture. And he did this by actually becoming public. He made his statement public by addressing the public policies. And in doing this, he makes the declaration that God is bringing judgment. And we see the judgment of drought. The declaration of judgment, chapter 17, verse 1, Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab, as the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand, There shall not be dew nor rain these years, according to my word. He says, until I let you know, it's not going to rain. There won't even be dew. I thought it's interesting that this is the first time we hear of Elijah. And all we know is that he's a Tishbite. People aren't quite sure what that means, but it sounds vicious. that he lived in Gilead, beautiful land. His name, however, means, the El is one name for God. Yah is short for Jehovah, another name for God. And so his name means Yahweh is God, or my God is Yahweh. And so I found it interesting that his very name was a declaration of taking the side of Jehovah God in a culture where they were saying, any God's okay. He says, hi, my name is, my God is Jehovah. And, you know, this was him taking a stand, and I kind of like that. He didn't fit in with the current crowd. He didn't wear sagging pants. He didn't wear clothes that showed that he was in with the gang, you know. He didn't do this kind of stuff. In fact, he was known for how he didn't fit in. 2 Kings 1:8, it comes like this. Who was that man? They answered him, he was an hairy man and girt with a girdle of leather about his loins. And he said, it's Elijah the Tishbite. Yeah, we know him. We know what he looks like. So here was a tough, rough guy that didn't mess around with silken garments, you know. He didn't have laced hankies sticking out of his sleeve to dab his nose. He was all man and ready to say what God said. So he declared that God was sending a drought that would continue until the prophet himself declared it at an end. What we need to know is he didn't make this up. This isn't him, God saying, I give you the power, now wreak havoc. This wasn't it. He was, in fact, standing as the representative of God, because God had already forewarned this. Just as he forewarned against rebuilding Jericho, he had forewarned about this. You leave me, you depart from me, and you'll have drought. Notice with me in Leviticus 26:19, God says, I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass. You don't get any water from iron. Squeeze it as much as you'd like. And when you don't have the water, the earth becomes hard as brass. A little more specific, Deuteronomy 11. Take heed to yourselves that your hearts be not deceived, and ye turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. And then the Lord's wrath be kindled against you, and he shut up the heaven that there be no rain, and that the land yield not her fruit, and lest ye perish quickly from off the good land which the Lord giveth you. He said this is what's going to happen. You and I need to look around and see what God said would happen if people live like they're living today. And we need to say with all boldness, with all toughness, I don't know what you thought you would expect to go exactly against what God says and find then that what is going to happen is exactly what he said would happen. These years is what he said. It warned that it would not be a short drought. With the end of rain comes the end of the crops. They don't blossom. They don't flower. They don't produce seed. They don't flag. So the crops at that point would be ruined. No crops would grow. And this for years, you see. And only after the rain began again could they begin to plant. Secondly, enduring the judgment. The fact that God's man reveals God's anger against sin doesn't mean that he will not bear some of the trouble himself. This isn't like us saying, ha ha ha, you have to bear the brunt of this problem. We all do. Look at the increase in crime with taking things the way our country is taking it goes against God's standard that if you will not work, you should not eat. The government says, oh, these people that don't want to work, they're having such a hard time. Let's just give them everything. And God says, it's not going to work that way. And so with an attitude that somebody's going to take care of you, no matter what, from cradle to the grave, then somebody doesn't have everything they want. They say, hey, that's not fair. And who isn't fair? Well, people that have more than I do. And so there's growing crime and growing drug addiction, which also breeds more crime. 1 Kings 17, 2-6, the word of the Lord came unto him, to Elijah, saying, get thee hence, turn thee eastward, and hide thyself by the brook Cherith that is before Jordan. It's kind of interesting that the word Cherith means separate or separation. He was taking a stand separate from the culture and actually makes his home there, you see. It's going to stop raining, and so the water is going to start drying up. The rivers will get smaller, the creeks will disappear. And so he says, go to a certain place. He gets there. It shall be that thou shalt drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed thee there. Now, we watch a lot of the food network channels, you know, and not yet have we found any raven that's any good cook at all. So they probably didn't bring him a bowl of beef stew. You know what I'm saying? What do they got? You know, they dropped something off for him, and he's saying, man, where'd you get that? You know, this. So a piece of bread somebody dropped, or maybe a warm loaf that they put on the windowsill. The raven took it, gave it to the prophet. The ravens were considered unclean animals, by the way. You're not going to eat a raven, you know. But whatever he did. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord. He went and dwelt by the brook Cherith that is before Jordan. So he didn't have any companionship. He didn't have any entertainment except watching ravens drop off food. And the ravens brought him bread and flesh. So there was some meat in the morning. Might have been a fish or something, I don't know. And bread and flesh in the evening, and he drank of the brook. So he had two meals a day. So he wasn't living in any kind of lap of luxury. And in fact, as the time passed, the very drought that he prophesied caused his brook to dry up. Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, states that on the authority of Menander, that the drought extended to Phoenicia, which is beyond Israel and toward the coast, and continued there for a full year. So the history records this terrible drought. God led Elijah then to go beyond the western limit of Ahab's kingdom to the Phoenician village of Zarephath near Sidon. Here's the story. The word of the Lord came unto him, saying, arise, get thee to Zarephath, which belongeth to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow woman there to sustain thee. So he arose, went to Zarephath. When he came to the gate of the city, there was no woman standing. There was a sign looking for Elijah, you know. But what does he find? A widow woman was standing there gathering of sticks. And he called to her and said, fetch me, I pray thee, a little water in a vessel that I may drink. And she turns, and as she was going to fetch it, he called to her and said, bring me, I pray thee, a morsel of bread in thine hand. And she said, sorry. As the Lord thy God liveth, I have not a cake, but an handful of meal in a barrel, and a little oil in a cruse. And you need both to make the bread. And behold, I am gathering two sticks, that I may go in and dress it for me and my son, that we may eat it and die. We've run out of food. We have nothing left. I'm a widow. We have nobody to support me. The son, evidently too young to be out working. So they run out. nothing else coming in. This was going to be their last meal. Elijah asked her to do something by faith. Elijah said unto her, "Fear not. Go and do as thou hast said, but make me thereof a little cake first, and bring it unto me." God always asks us to do something for him first. And if you're willing to do that, he'll open up heaven and earth for you. "And after, make for thee and for thy son. For thus saith the Lord God of Israel, the barrel of meal shall not waste, shall not become empty. Neither shall the cruse of oil fail until the day that the Lord sendeth or giveth rain upon the earth." And she went, saying, this guy's been out by some brook for too long, you know. But she went and did according to the saying of Elijah, and she and he and her house did eat many days. The King James margin here says, or a full year. And the barrel of meal wasted not. Now, we got the idea that it's going to be years. We know specifically, I'll give you these verses in a minute, 3.5 years. So how long was he there before the brook Cherith went out? I don't know. Was he there a full year? Probably that or less. So the rest of the time he spends with the widow, almost coming to the 3.5 years, because we have to leave time for him to travel back and get there and that, then pray for the rain and so on. But certainly what happened? The barrel of meal wasted not, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by, or by the hand, he spoke by the hand of Elijah. So during a time of judgment, God is able to preserve all his faithful through the difficulties. Here's the thing. You and I may cry out against the rebellion of our culture, and we should. We need to take God's side on this thing. We don't cooperate with it. We don't say, well, you know, it's just up to them. We're just saying to them, we're not saying like they did in Israel, God has commanded this country to be like this, you see. We are saying God has commanded men everywhere to be obedient to him. And to sin against him is to sin against yourself, and there are consequences for what you choose to do. Now, once you've said that, recognize that part of the problem will come back on you. Expect it, you see, expect it. However, realize that in the midst of it, God will be the preserver. You will not suffer any more than God will allow. And the suffering will make you stronger. It will make you more dependent on him. Well, the time comes, the ending of the judgment. 1 Kings 18:1, it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Show thyself unto Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." So it's already now in 3 years since it's happened. We find Luke 4:25, "But I tell you the truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout the land." Christ is giving this as an illustration that there were many widows in Israel, but God chose a woman outside of Israel because faith can be found outside of Israel. But he mentions specifically 3 years and 6 months. James is to remember, perhaps, that his brother Jesus said that. At any rate, James 5:17, "Elias was a man subject to like passions as we are," meaning of the same nature, that is, a fellow mortal, "and he prayed earnestly," or in his prayer, "that it might not rain, and it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months." So we have a specific time during which this happened. So God says to him, "Show yourself to Ahab as the herald of rain from Jehovah." Both man and beast in Israel had suffered greatly by the drought and the resulting famine, as you could well imagine, an agricultural society without rain for 3.5 full years. Here's an example of this, 1 Kings 18:5 and 6. Ahab said unto Obadiah, this is not the prophet Obadiah, this is another Obadiah who happens to work for King Ahab. He says to him, go into the land unto all fountains of water, unto all brooks. Peradventure, we may find grass to save the horses and mules alive, that we lose not all the beasts. The Hebrew here, that we cut not off ourselves from the beasts, that we lose them all, we don't have any more. So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went one way by himself. Obadiah went another way by himself. In vain, looking for any place where water was around enough to grow grass. Harvest it, take it back to the king, feed the king's beasts, at least we'll have horses. You see, what's going on is that the king, instead of getting right with God, had spent his time trying to locate Elijah. Besides trying to locate water and grass, he was trying to find Elijah. He had sent everybody out looking for him. You give me any report of him. Why? What was he going to do? I mean, I suppose to push him up against the wall and force him, make it rain! Make it rain or I'll hurt you! He didn't get the picture, did he? This is a man speaking for God. But they couldn't find him. For 3 years, they've been looking everywhere for him. And they've been chasing down every story. So somebody said, I think I saw that hairy guy over there. See, it wasn't him. He was over by the brook Cherith or outside the land. They all ran over there and looked, and sure enough, wasn't him. So it was believed that the Spirit of God had carried him away to some unknown, inaccessible, mysterious region. Atlantis. No, I don't know. But, you know, some place where they couldn't find. So Elijah comes walking up, and Obadiah meets him. And here's the conversation, 1 Kings 18:10 and 12. As the Lord thy God liveth, Obadiah says to Elijah, there is no nation or kingdom whither my Lord hath not sent to seek thee. And when they said, he is not there, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation that they found thee not. He said, you don't have him there? No. Sign this paper. Put your name on the line here that you don't have him. We'll go to war if you have him soon. It was that desperate. In verse 12, Obadiah says, yeah, you want me to go tell King Ahab that you're here. I come back, and the Spirit's going to have snatched you away someplace. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of the Lord shall carry thee, whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find thee, he shall slay me. Evidently he had done that before. But I, thy servant, fear the Lord from my youth. He says, I'm really on your side. Please don't kill me. Well, Elijah reassured him, no, I showed up because I want to be found. So 1 Kings 18:15, Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself unto him today. Well, the meeting of Ahab and Elijah after all of this trial, trouble, problems. And the king blames the preacher. You see, when we say you're doing wrong, when we say God will bring consequences upon you, and he does, we are blamed. We are hate mongers. We are stuck in the mud. We're old fashioned, you see. Listen to the words. And it came to pass, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, art thou he that troubleth Israel? Elijah didn't let him get away with that. Elijah recognized the presupposition that this was Elijah doing it. Elijah knew the truth as God had revealed it, so he says, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that you have forsaken the commandment of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. That's the plural, the Baals. There was more than one. All right. Now Elijah has come back. So what do they do? Elijah takes this time to prove Jehovah. 1 Kings 18, 19 and 20. Now therefore, Elijah volunteers, send and gather to me all Israel unto Mount Carmel. There's a mountain named Carmel. If you look at the maps of Israel, you follow the Mediterranean coast, and as you come down the coast, there's a little bump. You close in on that bump. That's Mount Carmel. So right there by the seaside, Mount Carmel, he says, gather to me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal, 450, and the prophets of the groves, the Asherah, 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. All this time, people starving, not the pagan priest. So Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel, gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. The first thing that Elijah did was to speak to the people of Israel that should have known better. Instead of following blindly, being the idiots that just walk the way somebody says walk, he charged them with halting, with limping, kind of hopping between two ways of thinking. The first way of thinking was that Jehovah should alone be worshipped. The other is Baal could be worshipped. Doesn't really matter. He demanded that both could not be true. If God is God, he says he's the only God, and you don't worship another God. So if he is God, you can't make the other choice. If Baal is God, then you don't also try to worship Jehovah. Here's the words. Elijah came unto all the people and said, how long halt ye between two opinions or thoughts? If Jehovah, the Lord, be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. You're keeping with your godly traditions. That's what the liberals are doing today. They say, be kind to people. Why? I thought you were an evolutionist. Survival of the fittest, the strongest, eat the weak. Why aren't you in there feasting on those weak people at the hospital? Worrying about people who can't fend for themselves? Why are you worried about that? Shouldn't we be wiping them out to be stronger in our species? That's the evolutionary way. But they borrow from their Christian past culture. And so they're halting between two opinions. But the people answered him not a word. They didn't know which way to go. He said, if God's the real one, follow him. If Baal is real, follow him. Forget the other one. We don't know what to do. So he puts up this idea. Then Elijah said unto the people, I only remain a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. So I'm up to the challenge. Let them, therefore, give us two bullocks. Let them choose one bullock for themselves, so that later they wouldn't say, oh, well, that was Elijah chose the bullock that would instantly burst into flame. You know, he didn't want this rumor around. They get to choose. Choose one bullock for themselves, cut it in pieces, lay it on wood, put no fire under it, and I will dress the other bullock and lay it on wood and put no fire under. And ye call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord, Jehovah. And the God that answereth by fire, let him be God. And all the people kind of looked at each other and answered, it's well spoken. The word is good. Good idea. That ought to prove something. Now, you say, Pastor, you're not saying that we should do this. Yes, I am, kind of. Not the way he did it, because we don't offer fire offerings of animals today. But proving God is a work that we should be doing today. Let me share with you some verses. Malachi 3:10. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now, God tells them, herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out, empty out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Now again, written to Israel, but in the New Testament it says, don't be a follower of Mammon, god of riches, and the god of heaven. Choose one or the other. See, God is able to supply all of your needs. So the Sermon on the Mount makes this very clear. Prove to the world that God is greater than their god of money. Do you understand how much the world worships money? Just before we left the house, my wife was listening to some awful program, watching it, and people got had a bathtub made out of a solid boulder of black onyx. I didn't see it.
Granite.
And the thing weighed over a ton. You couldn't move the thing. So they built a house around it and then jacked it up to the second floor or something. I don't know. So they're doing all this stuff, and the house was $22 million, if I remember. $22 million. If you had $22 million, you'd say, yes, I want a beautiful house with a giant black bathtub in the upstairs that weighs over a ton. You just naturally would say that. I don't know. I mean, you just stop to think, with $22 million, you could live the rest of your life, not worry about working. You could give attention to the things of the Lord. And once a year, you could give, $10,000 to everybody that you know that needs it. What a wonderful thing you could do with $22 million instead of buying a house, building a house. We can prove God to the world, prove to the world that God is greater than their god of money. Romans 12:2, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. Why? That you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. There's a proving to be done, putting to the test. Prove God to the world by showing the superior lifestyle of the obedient Christian. See, somebody may say to you, how come you don't have the problems that we do? How come you don't have, that illness? Or why don't you have the problems with all this stuff? And you say to them, are you just asking, or do you really want to know? How come I can get through this thing of my house burning down when other people go crazy? The answer is, I know the Lord. My lifestyle is a superior culture to yours. Not that I made it up. I'm just following what he told me. Prove God to the world by showing the superior lifestyle of the obedient Christian. 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourselves, he tells the church, whether you be in the faith. Prove your own selves. Know you not your own selves how that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be reprobate? You see what he's saying there is, prove God to the world by allowing them to see Jesus in you, Jesus in your life. You should act like Jesus. Peter said that he went about doing good. That's what we're all about, you see, helping when we can. We're giving service to man in love. Why? Because we find him so attractive? Hardly. Because our God asks us to do so, and we love him. Love your neighbor as yourself. Ephesians 5:10, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. He says, do it, you do it, and it works. You're proving what is acceptable in the Lord. So prove God to the world by testing all the ways that God finds acceptable. Get involved in that. See? Involve yourself in it. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. You see, prove God to the world in everything you do. So leave nothing to tradition. Leave nothing to the current fads. You don't go with the flow. You don't drift down the river. You're taking a stand on a rock and letting the river part around you, you see. You're putting everything to the test to see if it's God's way or not. And so you prove God to the world in that. And then again, 1 Peter 1:7. That the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried, this is the same word that we've been looking at, the Greek word, though it be tried with fire, proved with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. Elijah sat by a brook, eating food brought by dirty birds until the brook dried up. He was suffering along with everybody else in his own way. Prove God to the world by the way you endure suffering for Christ's sake. Elijah's test proved the false gods could not do what people expect gods to do. You look at these people, you talk to these people, engage them in conversation, find out what their gods are, and say, how's that working for you? Do you have love, joy, peace, long-suffering, temperance, goodness, meekness, all the fruit of the Spirit? How's this working for you? Although the priests were passionate and sincere, nothing happened. Nothing changed. You want to understand passionate and sincere? Listen to this. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their manner with knives and lancets till the blood gushed out upon them, or poured out blood upon them. And it came to pass, when the midday was past, and they prophesied until the time of the offering, the ascending of the evening sacrifice, there was neither voice, nor any to answer, nor any that regarded. Nobody paid any attention. There was nobody there. They kept calling, and nobody was home. This is what's happening in our world today. I find it fascinating that they gave up about the time, or the people gave up on them, about the time, as it said, of the evening sacrifice. They were to have a sacrifice morning and evening. The evening sacrifice, where you took an animal and you sacrificed it to God, and you said, thank you for your bounty. Thank you for giving us enough to eat. Well, they weren't doing that because they were eating every animal they could get a hold of because famine and drought and the animals were dying. But it was about the time when normally they would have the evening sacrifice. And notice that he used the normal worship time and an old altar to focus all the attention on the old-time religion. Wasn't in fashion in his day, but it was true. Verse 30, Elijah said unto the people, come near unto me. And all the people came near unto him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down. There it was. They saw it. He found 12 stones, arranged them, one for each of the tribes of Israel, and put the wood upon it. So he says, I'm going back to the old way that never failed us. I'm going back to the God that led us here and kept us all this time. We could say, I'm going back to the faith of the very pilgrims who invented this democracy when they came, you see. He emphasized in his proving, he emphasized the supernatural character of the proof. This wasn't about him. I'm smarter than these priests. I'm stronger than these. But that's not it. He was emphasizing the supernatural character. He was letting God prove himself. Look at verses 33 to 35. And he put wood in order and cut the bullock in pieces and laid him on the wood and said, fill four barrels with water and pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood. Now, somebody was preaching this and they said, well, I don't know where after 3.5 years they found four barrels of water. This is right by the Sea of Mediterranean Sea. There was still water in there. You just couldn't drink it. So they got four barrels, climbed back up Mount Carmel, poured it over there, and he says, do it again. And they did it a second time. Then he says, do it a third time. They did it a third time. Well, now this very parched ground is a mud pit. He had dug a trench around the altar. Now it's filled, it's a moat around the altar. What's he doing? He's showing that there's no little trick Bic lighter over here to, you know, and light the thing. Hey, God did that. See? He stands back and emphasizes the supernatural character of the proof. And I want you to notice this, that in this, he doesn't take all the attention's on him, but he turns the attention to God and gives them a sense of expectancy about what God would do. 36, 37. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, the God who led us all that way in the past, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that thou art Jehovah God, and that thou hast turned their heart back again. God wanted to prove himself. That's why he led Elijah to do this. And I believe that God wants to prove himself in this culture as well. So we're going to be people that don't look like the world, don't act like the world, don't speak like the world, don't watch what the world watches. We don't read what the world reads. But we say, we're doing what God says. Look at me. Look at my life. Look what happens to me. And see if you can say the same about you and your God. I give all the glory to him. Then the fire of the Lord fell. Suppose that was a lightning bolt. I don't know what it was. But the fire of God fell and consumed the burnt offering, the bullock, and the wood, and the stones. That's a pretty hot fire, probably more than a lightning blast. And the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. There was a seething, crackling crater where all that stuff used to be. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, Jehovah, he is the God. Jehovah, he is the God. Wouldn't it be great to have some people who say, I didn't believe, I thought anything was okay, all religions were equal. But when I saw him active in your life, when you challenged me about my belief, I found out that there's only one God. God's man then urged the people to apply the truth they had just learned in a practical way. Well, this is pretty gory, but they should rid themselves of the very ones who had led to their misery and their destruction, the people that were urging them on in this false belief. And Elijah said unto them, take or apprehend the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape. And they took them. Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. Donated their water to the earth. with the matter proved, the people being adjusted, God ended the judgment and sent rain to feed the earth. I love the picture of this, so I wanted to include it, even though we take it for granted. Elijah said unto Ahab, get thee up and eat and drink, for there is a sound of abundance of rain, or a sound of a noise of rain. So Ahab went up and sat down and ate. Elijah went to the top of Carmel, cast himself down upon the earth. This is squatting down, because it says, and put his face between his knees. He was pretty limber for an old guy. And he said to his servant, I'm going to be here praying. You go up now and look toward the sea. And he went up and looked, and he said, there's nothing. He said, go again, seven times. So he keeps coming back, telling him, nope, nothing, no, nothing. And it came to pass at the seventh time that he said, behold, there ariseth a little cloud out of the sea like a man's hand. Just a tiny little thing. Elijah jumps up. Go up, say unto Ahab, prepare thy chariot, get thee down, that the rain stop thee not. And it came to pass in the meanwhile that the heaven was black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And that limber Elijah ran on foot ahead of the chariot all the way there. Must have been good food the ravens were bringing or something. That supernatural flour and oil from the widow kept filling up those barrel and the cruse. Put him in good stead. Wouldn't it be great to be an Elijah of Jehovah God in our day? To confront the people with their false ideas of what religion is all about and why they should be religious in the first place. You and I have the opportunity, as we've mentioned, to prove these things to the world by our very Christian life and our words and our actions. Let's dedicate ourselves to the doing of that. Let's bow for prayer. Father, you give us an opportunity tonight to imagine ourselves an Elijah of the present day, not fitting in with the in crowd and the world around us, but rather standing true to you in the face of that crowd. I ask, Father, that you might help us to recognize as we interact with the people around us, as we meet people, non-Christians, here, there, and everywhere, that we would seek to engage them in conversation, to direct them to your way with us, your guidance for us. I ask that you might give us the opportunity to confront them with the failure of those that they consider to be their gods. I pray, Father, that you might help us then to see some of them come to the realization, falling as it were upon their face, saying, Jehovah is the God. That we might win people to thee in the midst of a rebellious culture. We know it's possible, as Elijah did it. We ask that it might be possible with us. And we take that challenge, we take that goal. Pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.